welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program today, a huge volcano region has been discovered in Antarctica. With ice sheets melting from climate change, scientists are scrambling to work out just what could happen. And could there be a benefit for the biosphere?
You can imagine what happens when lava temperature of 800 or 1,000 degrees that hits the bottom of the ice. You can imagine what happens there, but also it's linked to the way the ice evolves. So if the volume of the ice sheet changes, we can see increases or reduces in the amount of volcanic activity, is one hypothesis anyway.
And German Chancellor Angela Merkel has what appears to be an unassailable lead in the polls. But could anything happen in the next couple of weeks? Stay tuned for this story coming up now. Well, on September the 24th, the Germans will elect a new parliament. Chancellor Angela Merkel is seeking a fourth term. Her party, the Christian Democrats, are ahead of the Social Democratic Party by 15%. On Saturday, the head of the German government embarked on her electoral campaign with her first meeting in Dortmund in the west of the country. Wire reporter Joanna Cabot has more.
On Saturday, August 12th, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel started her election campaign with a rally in Dortmund. The legislative elections will take place on September 24th, and Merkel is vowing to stay on as Chancellor for a fourth term. Even after 12 years in power, Merkel is frequently called the world's most powerful woman and Europe's de facto leader. Merkel's conservative Christian Democrats lead their closest rivals, the Social Democrats, by a 12 to 17 point margin, meaning it would take a political earthquake to shift the field at this point. Professor Jürgen Brammer, dean of the Law School of Murdoch University in Perth, says that Angela Merkel still has her skeptics.
There is a strong feeling that overall her leadership has been very beneficial on the one hand, but there are some significant voices that say that it has been indecisive at times, that it has failed to provide a sharper political focus. I think that especially among her own party, the Christian Democratic Union.
Professor Simon Tarmi, head of the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Sydney, believes Angela Merkel has the profile of a leader and will be re-elected without a doubt.
She's seen as a very reliable and trusted leader. She's extremely pragmatic. She's not someone who has got a very strong ideological agenda. She is the perfect captain of a ship which is on stormy seas. And I think for that reason that she'll make it to be Chancellor of Germany when the elections roll around in 6 weeks' time.
The Social Democrats party leader Martin Schulz is the former president of the European Parliament. He is well behind Merkel in the polls, and Simon Tarmi says German voters have little to choose from as both run on similar platforms.
The problem that the Germans have got is really that Schulz's politics are very, very similar to Merkel's. They're both centrist politicians. Merkel leans a little bit more towards the market. She's probably a more kind of centre-right figure. But Schulz is on the right-hand side of the SPD party, which is a fairly kind of centrist party anyway. So what German people are asking themselves is, well, do we eject the person who's been in charge for 12 years in favour of someone about whom we actually know very little? Schulz has never held a ministerial position. He doesn't seem to have a great deal of experience running anything. He's quite a sensible figure. He's got some virtues and so on, but almost a kind of sense that, you know, better with the devil that you know rather than the devil that you don't.
In Germany, the Grand Coalition describes the governing coalition of the two main centre-right and centre-left parties, that is, the Christian Democrats, the CDU, led by Merkel, and the Social Democrats, the SPD, led by Schulz. Simon Tarmi explains.
It's basically a parliamentary system where you need an absolute majority in the Bundestag in order to be able to nominate the Chancellor, and you can never really do that because no party is capable of making 50%. So as things stand, the CDU will probably poll somewhere between 37 and 40%, something like that, and so they need a partner. Up to now, they've basically looked to the other centrist party, the SPD, in order to give them that sort of ballast. And I think in a context of sort of international security crises and so on, I think the SPD would be very foolish not to join a grand coalition along alongside the CDU. I can't see there being too many difficulties there, precisely because I think Schulz recognises that his time hasn't quite come, that the sensible thing to do is to join with Merkel for this next parliamentary session and try to build his popularity and his programme and his distinctiveness as a relatively new SPD leader. So that we're all expecting a grand coalition to emerge out of the back end of this.
Jürgen Brammer thinks that unlike the recent French elections or the UK elections, the polls are pretty accurate.
There won't be any surprises in this election. That would be my prediction. If you describe surprise as in, you know, when we looked at the French elections, that Front National and Marine Le Pen could actually, you know, maybe even win, no, there is no such surprise.
Simon Turmey agrees about the poll predictions, and unless a major crisis in the political landscapes appears, the election is for Angela Merkel to lose.
I think the polls are to be believed on this one. I mean, we know polling is an imprecise science, but she's so far ahead. She's over 10 points ahead from Schulz. It would take something pretty catastrophic to happen now for that poll lead to disappear. The kind of things that we might be thinking of is a kind of renewed immigration wave or another crisis which brings a whole load of people into the picture, and which then, you know, gets Germans arguing about whether they want to receive quite so many people, or there's some sort of jolt to the macroeconomy, but that's very difficult to see as well. I mean, I think we're, you know, 6 weeks away. It's very difficult to see her lead being disrupted by any kind of outside international events.
Professor Simon Turmey, Professor of Politics from the University of Sydney there, ending that report by Joanna Cabot. Well, to mark National Science Week, The Wire shines a spotlight on the discovery of dozens of volcanoes under the ice cap in Antarctica. The finding, announced overnight, could see the continent overtake East Africa to become the world's most densely concentrated volcanic region. Nicole Ng and Philip Stempion have the details.
Scientists have revealed the largest volcanic region in the world could be in Antarctica. The latest discovery of 91 volcanoes brings the total number of volcanoes on the continent to 138. Scientists are analysing what could happen if these volcanoes become active, as well as the possible impact they have on global warming. The latest discovery was made with the help of ice-penetrating radar measurements. Dr. Alan Atkin is a geophysicist at the University of Western Australia, and he's used this technology in his own research on glacial melting.
Fires out a radio pulse from an aircraft or from a platform on the ground. And then what we're doing is we're waiting for that signal to penetrate through the ice and then hit the base of the ice sheet where there's a rock or potentially water down there. And then we wait for the rebound of that signal to come back up to the platform. And so that time delay from it going down and going up tells us how thick the ice is. And from that, we can map out the shape of the bed of the ice sheet. And we can also see some features within the ice itself that might be important as well.
Scientists have been using ice-penetrating radar since the 70s, but before that, they had to rely on some pretty explosive methods.
The earliest ways of doing it was with sound waves. You would take some dynamite out and blow it up at the top of the ice sheet and wait to hear the response from the sound travelling through the ice and hitting the base of the ice sheet and coming back up. But that was much lower resolution and also much more sort of complicated and environmentally difficult to apply. So the radar is much easier to use for that purpose.
Geologist and Professor Sylvia Freesia is part of an environmental and climate change research group. She says the new research complements other scientific methods which have shown that these volcanoes are up to tens of thousands of years ago.
We know that volcanism has been going on in Antarctica subglacially, meaning eruption from volcanoes that are under the ice, from volcanoes we might not even know that exist, because we found the indirect evidence that they actually do exist. We found by looking at the chemical characteristics of some carbonates that precipitated at the boundary between the ice and rock, 1,000 meters or 700 meters of ice, between 25,000 and 23,000 years ago.
Professor Freesia says she's not surprised by the discovery because Antarctica lies on a rift, meaning tectonic activity isn't unusual. But what is remarkable is that the newly discovered region could dwarf the East African Ridge, which is currently the world's densest concentration of volcanoes.
We keep discovering things, and Antarctica is unknown. people don't even know that there are volcanoes, and there are volcanoes in Western Antarctica, Eastern Antarctica, because it's on a rift zone. It means the plate that make up the crust of the Earth is a place where they are moving apart. There are volcanoes all along a very, very, very long region, which is comparable to Africa.
Dr. Alan Atkins says these subglacial volcanoes could have worrying consequences on the glaciers that covered them, should they erupt.
You can imagine what happens when lava at a temperature of 800 or 1,000 degrees hits the bottom of the ice. You can imagine what happens there, but also it's linked to the way the ice evolves. So if the volume of the ice sheet changes, we can see increases or reduces in the amount of volcanic activity, is one hypothesis anyway.
But this is only a theory, and although many suspect ice melt could contribute negatively to climate change, Professor Sylvia Frisier says it could actually help counter global warming.
Melting ice, both in Greenland and Antarctica, provides iron to the ocean. It can be used by microorganisms to eat better and bloom. Then once they die, they sequester carbon down back into the ocean again. Iron fertilization can help to speed up cooling, but at the same time, if we have volcanoes putting up in the atmosphere additional carbon dioxide, then the story becomes very difficult to model.
But the Antarctic ecosystem is extremely complex, and the impact of melting ice on these volcanoes is not yet known.
I really think that we ought to think about the Earth as a dynamic system. And the best thing we can do is still to try not to release too many greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. If we cannot manage to do that, there are many things we do not know. Some are good, some are not, still are unable to take into consideration every single factor.
Professor Sylvia Frisier there, ending that report from Philip Stempien and Nicole Ng.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with a wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
Well, there are ongoing problems for Indigenous communities to protect their knowledge and culture through the current laws that are supposed to protect intellectual property. The wider problem revolves around notions of identity, importance of country, and cultural understanding for the oldest living culture in the world. Daniel Sleeman has more.
When it comes to protecting Indigenous knowledge and culture in artworks, one aspect of the debate that is not given enough attention is how cultural appropriation affects Indigenous artists. Dennis Stokes, director of Mimi Aboriginal Art and Craft in the Northern Territory, was asked this very question.
It affects them quite a lot because the way that people paint in our region is very traditional. There are stories, there's ways, there's protocols you have to follow in terms of what you're painting. People can't paint things for the sake of painting. So we live in a river region. People paint things from their river.
Indigenous artwork production needs to be understood in terms of the spiritual capital attached to its making, the responsibility of that particular artist.
I always get questions like, why does this certain artist paint bush tomatoes? Because that's her responsibility, that's her dreaming, that's what she looks after. That's her spiritual side.
The imitation of Aboriginal artworks and culture by non-Indigenous people is also considered an insult for many Indigenous people. Tommy Lewis, director of Gilpin Arts, is one of those offended.
People who imitate that are actually spitting at our face, you know, like a worthless mob of don't have anything.
Tommy Lewis is also a well-renowned performer, actor and musician who describes imitation as an offence to family and campfire.
If you're making fun of my totems and my we say Marian, my law, my ranga, my gulinga, that handed down to from my grandfathers, it's an insult directly to my campfire. of my families.
The standard to which Indigenous people are held and punished should apply to non-Indigenous people.
If I do another man, countryman painting, I can be really punished for it. So when people who are doing Aboriginal artwork faking it and have not sat with the families, should be punished the same.
One of the problems at the heart of this issue is the conflict of laws and customs and the absence of permission from elders.
The Westfall law don't consider our law if we use our law to get these people punished. How we do get punished. We get punished from two laws. And one of the things we have to watch is not to duplicate what we know without the permission of the elders.
Recently, the issue of cultural appropriation came full circle with Chanel manufacturing a boomerang which retailed for almost $2,000. Bibi Barber, a Dhurrumbal artist and coordinator at Artists in the Black, had this to say on the Chanel boomerang.
Well, it's obviously misappropriation of cultural heritage, really, of Chanel, what they've done with the boomerang, and it has no connection whatsoever to culture. And really, this is what we have to look at. The Australian government have to really have a long look at the fact of its consumer laws. And this is where, obviously, you know, with Bob Katter, the bill to reform or to create a new legislation to pretty much, you know, address this issue.
Bob Katter recently introduced a bill into Parliament to address the issue of Indigenous cultural protection. This law needs to reflect community voices.
So we want to see, you know, more implementation of in legislation regarding the bill, you know, Bob Katter's bill to be refined and to have that process and to voice our opinion in how that is to be, you know, delivered to the community, because it's all Australia. You know, it's everyone in Australia that is being affected.
When it comes to current laws, they simply don't work to protect Indigenous culture and knowledge. Professor Natalie Stoyanov identifies some of the difficulties with the current laws.
A lot of problems with the current laws. The difficulty, I suppose, rests in the way that intellectual property rights operate compared to the way cultural property is dealt with within Aboriginal and other Indigenous communities. For example, intellectual property rights very much aimed at rewarding the individual creator, and usually for a fixed period of time. The difficulty for cultural property then is that more often than not there is no specific inventor or created.
Asked about what the central problem is when it comes to dealing with cultural knowledge, Professor Stoyanov had this to say.
Combination of lack of understanding. Certainly third-party interests, large organisations have been dealing with this sort of information and data as something which belongs to humanity as a whole, rather than recognising that knowledge as something special.
Professor Natalie Stoyanov of UTS Faculty of Law, ending that report by Daniel Sleeman. Chambers, I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio around Australia. Last week, the federal government introduced amendments to the secrecy provisions of the controversial Australian Border Force Act. The amendments aim to repeal sections of the Act that forbid people who work at detention facilities from speaking out about the conditions. Human rights advocates are welcoming the changes but are cautiously optimistic because they haven't been passed yet. Annalisa Gracias-Flor has more.
George Newhouse is one of the founders of the National Justice Project, an advocacy organisation that aims to advance human rights and social justice in Australia. He says that the detention workers affected by the secrecy provisions within the Border Force Act were scared about the potential repercussions of speaking out.
They were incredibly intimidated, and their right to free speech and to speak out against injustices and cruelty had been severely limited. Some of them were afraid that they might be arrested if they spoke about people in desperate medical need or people who'd been abused or harmed in immigration detention.
He says the new laws are a victory and they are a direct result of the government receiving advice that they will lose their pending cases in the High Court.
I believe that these new laws are a victory. These changes are as a direct result of the Australian government receiving advice that they're going to lose that case. It will be an embarrassment for them, and the amendments to the law are necessary as a consequence of that litigation.
George says that he and others are cautiously optimistic about the changes, as the bill has not been passed yet.
The feedback I'm getting is cautious optimism. They're hopeful that these new changes will lead to their ability to speak openly about the things that they've seen in immigration detention. But it's worth noting that this is only a bill. It's still got to go to a Senate committee in September, and the law hasn't actually gone through Parliament yet.
Green Senator Nick McKim echoes George's sentiment, saying that the government has backflipped, but not for the right reasons.
This is a humiliating backdown for not only Peter Dutton, but Malcolm Turnbull as well. They've been telling us for years how important these draconian secrecy provisions are. But at the end of the day, they're backing down because they knew they were going to lose this case in the High Court, and the High Court would have ruled that those draconian secrecy provisions in Section 42 of the Border Force Act were a disproportionate limitation on freedom of political communication in Australia. So a humiliating backdown, but not in the name of compassion or decency, simply done in the name of expediency. So our position, we've never supported the draconian secrecy provisions in Section 42. We voted against them, unlike both the Labor and Liberal parties who colluded to put them into the law. And we welcome any relaxation of what were absolutely unreasonable limitations on what a lot of people could say about the horrors that they've witnessed, not only on Manus Island and Nauru, but within Australia's onshore detention network.
Jeannie Walker is the national spokesperson for refugees and asylum seekers. She says that more transparency could fix the issue of misinformation being spread within the Australian public.
Hopefully, this will mean that we get more transparency and the capacity for the Australian people to better understand the horrors that have been done in their name and the harms that have deliberately been caused to people on Manus Island and Nauru.
Jeannie hopes that the new changes, if they pass, will shine a light on the truth about the injustice for refugees coming to Australia.
I think that the truth has got to come out. It's got to come out completely, and it's got to be unhindered by government trying to cover up what they've done. I think it's time for them to just step up, admit they've made a huge mistake, and do everything in their power and in our power to rectify it.
Jeannie Walker, President and National Spokesperson for Refugees and Asylum Seekers, ending that report by Annalisa Gracias-Flor.
Reception isn't always the best out here in the bush. But if I miss The Wire, I listen to the podcast.
The Wire. Across Australia, weeknights on Indigenous and Community Radio. And now podcast.
And just in breaking news, the New Zealand government has confirmed that Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce is a New Zealand citizen, or is able to be a New Zealand citizen. He told Parliament he had decided to refer himself to the High Court for clarification, but would not resign from Cabinet and would remain as the member for the New South Wales electorate of New England.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
You've been listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on your local station. I'm Roderick Chambers. that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite download app. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. The Wire is a team effort by 2SER Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane. You can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. Back again tomorrow, so please tune in again. I'm Roderick Chambers. Thanks for your company.